Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dry Dock episode 389. This week, the questions are taken from Guide 457 to HMS Incomparable, the Wednesday video on Typhoon Connie-Viper, and the Friday video on We Have Ways Fest 2025. So let's begin. Zep Flyer asks, on ships that filled sacrificial bows and sterns with cork for flotation, were there ever any instances of massive amounts of tinder catching fire? And was it treated in any way to prevent this? Not as far as I'm aware. When ships were filled with cork at the bows and sterns, inflexible, as you can see here, is actually a good example of this. Generally, the cork would be somewhat treated, although it was mostly on the basis of trying to prevent rot and preserve it, which admittedly some of the things that you'd use to preserve it that do actually make the thing more flammable. But of course, you will get water infiltration and damp, which is why you have the anti-rot treatment. But to be perfectly honest, there was stuff stored in the bow and stern that was far, far, far more flammable. Paint was very typically stored in the bow. And later on, you'd get aviation fuel and things like that stored in either the bow or stern, sometimes also fuel for the ship's boats, precisely because it was very flammable. And with the best oil in the world, the extreme bow and stern, especially the bow, is about the safest place to store that because it's about as far away as you're going to get from anything really vital like the magazines or the machinery spaces. And it's a relatively small space. So even if the whole thing goes up in flames, you aren't massively in danger at that immediate point. And you do actually see a number of cases where fires, especially in the bow, when paint lockers and things catch fire, are allowed to burn out, and essentially they just create a perimeter to stop it spreading. So cork-filled bows and sterns, I don't think there's a particular record of them specifically catching fire, but it wouldn't have been a massive deal if they did, any more than a fire generally is bad news. Potato Peeler 42 asks, evening Drac, I recently read Captain Hara's Japanese Destroyer Captain. In part 5, The Last Sortie, Operation Tengo, Captain Hara mentions that Yahagi received proximity fuses, homing torpedoes, and radar sets. The addition of radar sets seems likely, but I've never heard of the Imperial Japanese Navy possessing the former two. If they existed in some form, how were they developed and how was their performance? And if not, what could Captain Hara have been referring to? So, the Japanese did technically possess proximity fuses and homing torpedoes, but not in any substantial numbers or in any way that manifestly affected the front line. So they did experiment with acoustic homing torpedoes, but they couldn't make them work fully, so they never deployed them to the front line. They had, you know, maybe a dozen or so test torpedoes. So they technically had them, but not for war usage. Proximity fuses were a little bit more of an advanced case. They actually developed a photoelectric fuse, which the British actually looked at early on in the war as well. And in some ways, obviously, works a little bit like a radar fuse, but with using photoelectric effects, i.e. looking for light. Now, the Germans had photoelectric cells, for example, to help trigger some of their upward-firing guns in anti-bomber fighters and so forth. Now, that was a bit more advanced than their homing torpedo work. They did actually manage to make some working versions of those photoelectric proximity fuses, but there's no indication that they reached mass deployment on a front line basis, more that they're just substantially more advanced in their testing. There's also some indication that they were working on a form of radio proximity fuse, but that was, if you believe the reports, it was less of a radar proximity fuse in the manner that the US one used, and more of a remotely detonated fuse. So obviously you'd only use that on really big anti-aircraft shells because you'd need to track where that thing was, either visually or perhaps using radar. And then when it got to, you know, proximity to an allied aircraft, then you would cause it to detonate rather than sailing on straight past it, which is what, obviously, without that kind of thing, it might well do. However, that information for that kind of fuse is very sketchy, in my view. The photoelectric fuse is much better sourced, but again, you know, neither that nor homing torpedoes would have been equipped on Yahagi in the run-up to Tengo. So what was Captain Hara referring to? I don't know, but if I had to guess, I would either guess that perhaps he was misremembering when he was recalling things after the war, or perhaps he was conflating them being issued some kind of new special upgraded anti-aircraft equipment and new torpedoes. And maybe that's then conflated later on in his mind with, well, they gave us this new stuff. You know, here's a new, more effective anti-aircraft shell. And then, of course, later on, going, oh, well, clearly newer, more effective anti-aircraft shells in the context of World War II are proximity fuses. That must be what they've given us. I mean, it's very theoretically possible that Yahagi was somehow equipped with the very few actual, you know, photoelectric fused AA shells and the handful of acoustic homing torpedoes the Japanese had for some reason. But I would think that very implausible. Chris Reiter asks, Admiral Fisher stated, she'll shake to pieces in about 10 years, but what's the good of a warship lasting longer? The expletive deleted things get obsoleted in about a year. My question is, what would Fisher's reaction to or opinion be if he learned that ships subsequent to his lifetime would be in service with refits and overhauls for decades, with navies seeking to squeeze every conceivable year out of them due to treaty or financial considerations? I think Fisher's reaction to treaties extending the life of capital ships, particularly the Washington and London naval treaties, he would have understood, given the treaty, why their lives needed to be extended. But I think he would have some pretty choice words to say about the treaties themselves. I can very well imagine him saying something slightly, a slightly less polite version of, you know, this is a completely stupid treaty. We need the sea to survive. We're giving away a position that makes us joint equals rather than the top dog. We're the only ones who need to be the top dog. And moreover, by limiting ourselves, we're giving us putting ourselves in a position where the potential other hostile navies who aren't bound by these treaties but are currently much smaller could conceivably build up quickly enough to challenge and possibly overtake us, and even those who are limited by treaty are within shouting distance of our strength, and therefore if they get a head start by deciding to unilaterally break the treaties, they'll get a head start on us. Just look at how Germany very rapidly went from nothing to the second largest navy on the planet in the 1900s. That is pretty much, I can assure you, what Fisher would have said about the treaties, and he largely would have been right. As far as the just keeping the ships in service for so long, as I said, if he was fated, given the treaties of fait accompli, he would probably turn around and say, okay, well, why aren't we experimenting with these ships? You know, we've got to get rid of some. They can't be frontline combatants. Fine. But why aren't we taking, like, say, in the late 20s, early 30s, why aren't we taking something like the Iron Dukes and using one of them as an experimental ship to test all sorts of new guns, both anti-air and anti-ship, new armor, new machinery. You know, why aren't we at least preparing upgrades for both new build ships and modernizations? And why are we just letting everything stagnate? And similarly, when you get to the Cold War, I think he'd just be yelling at people for a complete lack of imagination and development. Because he's used to the idea of naval technology being able to advance very quickly because of a highly competitive environment, both commercially and politically. Although I do think he would approve of things in the more modern context like box launchers and VLS cells, because that's a generic launcher into which you can fit all sorts of new and interesting weaponry as it comes along. So I think he'd be quite approving of those kind of things. He wouldn't necessarily be as approving of just keeping building the same hulls for decades on ends, or you know, especially when it came to the Royal Navy. He would be on an absolute warpath about the Navy being subordinate to the Treasury rather than almost vice versa. Atypical Programmer asks, what does honeycombed mean in the context of a warship? I've heard Dr. Clark throw that term around on occasion. In its classic sense, as with the Italia, like as seen here, honeycombed essentially is another way of describing incredibly intense subdivision. So obviously, most warships are subdivided quite heavily compared to merchant ships for watertight integrity and damage control. But you do have areas where you have relatively large open compartments, which are in place mostly for comfort, and that there's a balance struck between the need for subdivision and the general need for crew comfort. So, for example, wardrooms, mess decks, and so forth, although they tend to be usually higher up in the ship, will tend to be relatively expansive to fit a decent number of men. Or boiler rooms might have several boilers in them, especially in the ironclad and early steel ship era. Magazines, if we're looking at stuff that's further down, or coal bunkers, or oil tanks later on, might be made up of a few large spaces, simply because that's easier to handle or transport the various things that are inside them. Whereas, if you are going to honeycomb a structure, well, you know, as the name suggests, like a beehive, what you would be doing is deliberately making not the smallest practical, but the smallest possible spaces. So let's take a coal bunker, for example. You might have a coal bunker that is, I don't know, 40 feet by 30 feet. Now, that will fit a nice amount of coal. You can shove coal out of it, fine. You could divide that into a series of 10 foot by 15 foot individual coal bunkers. It'll be much more difficult to access them, and you drain each one somewhat faster, and it would complicate the running of the ship, but you could do it. And similarly with magazines, you know, you might want a shell room and a magazine, but you could divide the magazine into six separate smaller magazines and the shell room perhaps into four or five shell rooms, all of which have to feed into a central hoisting room. Now, that will slow down your supply of ammunition unless you put lots of extra men in on it. And obviously, it all does add more weight because you've got a lot more steel in there dividing things up. So normally, people will go for fewer larger rooms there, but you can do that smaller subdivision if you want to. And the point of doing that smaller subdivision is essentially to increase the water tightness of a ship. So typically, honeycombing is done in areas of the ship that would be lightly protected or not protected at all by conventional armour, hence why Italia was kind of a pioneer for this. And the idea is, let's say if you consider a shell coming in just aft of the machinery spaces on a typical ship, assuming it's managed to defeat armour on a normal vessel, if it detonates somewhere between the aft machinery space and the magazines, there may only be one or two compartments between the two, and thus fragments from the shell and fragments from the explosion might well punch into and damage or set fire to things in both your aftmost engine room and the forward of most of your aft magazines. It's a very unlucky hit, and that's why you would obviously cover it with armor, but there's not a huge amount once that shell gets through stopping that from occurring. And of course, if there's flooding, that's two fairly large compartments exposed to the water. Whereas with a honeycomb structure, then if that same shell, obviously not really stopped by armour at this point, but so it goes through anyway and it explodes, those one or two compartments in between the magazine and the machinery spaces might be six, at which point, yeah, sure, the fragments in the explosion might wreck most, if not all of them, but maybe there might be one that remains unbreached by sheer roll of the dice. That's a bit of extra flotation for you. And of course, if the explosion and the fragments have to punch through in either direction, let's say three bulkheads instead of one or two, they are going to be considerably slowed, so they're not going to do as much damage once they get to the more vital areas. And if your engine room, let's say, has been divided into three compartments instead of one, and your magazines have been divided into six compartments instead of one, then a given individual shell fragment can only cause flooding or damage in one of those compartments, assuming it doesn't punch through to another one. And even if you get several breaches, then let's say your engine room has been divided into three sections, two are breached, but one isn't. So again, there's some utility retained, some flotation retained, and same with the magazines. You might end up with fragments in three of your six sections, but that means half of your magazine is still unbreached, whereas before the whole magazine would be breached. And of course, a small amount of explosive in any one given place is perhaps slightly less likely to cook off. Now, as I said, the trade-off is the ship overall weighs more in terms of its structure, and it's going to run less efficiently. But you can kind of see where some of the benefits would come from. And honeycombing is basically this, but on a very large scale, and say usually in unarmored areas. Andrew Romash asks, how important is wind during a carrier takeoff? Have there been instances where aircraft were spotted and prepared for launch, but the wind died down, forcing the launch to be aborted or the planes to be rearmed with lighter payloads? Is it possible to launch an attack while steaming downwind if the situation is urgent? And in such cases, how much lighter would the aircraft need to be? It's a highly variable situation. So yes, there have been instances where aircraft were spotted and prepared for launch, but the wind died, and that meant you couldn't launch. I mean, going a little bit past when the channel normally covers, but the Argentinian carrier Venta Cinco de Mayo was theoretically preparing to launch A4 Skyhawks at the British during the Falklands War, except that on the day they chose for launch, there wasn't any wind. And because, well, Venta Cinco de Mayo was a British light fleet carrier originally that had been heavily retrofitted to be able to operate jet aircraft, it needed that wind. And the reason I say, you know, it's a somewhat variable equation is because you've got lots of different factors to take into account. So just in terms of airspeed over the deck, if the wind dies, that's not the only component of airspeed over the deck. You've, of course, got the fact the ship's movement itself. So if the wind is completely still, but the ship can do 30 knots, you're still going to get, roughly speaking, 30 knots of wind over the deck. And if you've got a catapult, of course, the catapult can get your airspeed up before you reach the end of the flight deck a lot faster than just using your normal acceleration would be capable of doing. And then, like you said, you know, if you're running downwind, the question is, well, how fast are you running downwind and how fast is downwind? Because if you've got, say, a 40 knot wind coming up behind you and you're running downwind at 30 knots, then theoretically you've still got a 10 knot tailwind. Now, for various atmospheric reasons, that's not quite how it works. There would be a bit of variance on that, but for a rough and ready discussion, we can kind of take that. Whereas obviously if it's a 30 knot wind tailwind and you're traveling at 30 knots, then in theory you're in flat calm. And if it's only a 10 knot tailwind and you're moving at 30 knots, then you've actually got 20 knots over the flight deck, again, in theory. So that is going to affect, obviously, how much you can launch, because an aircraft that might be able to launch with a 20 knots going past its wings on the flight deck might not be able to launch if it's got 10 knots coming behind it on the same flight deck. And then you've also got to consider, what is the aircraft and how much flight deck have you got? Obviously, these days, with aircraft mostly using catapult launches, or they have a fixed launch spot, they just keep that area clear and the aircraft goes off. Whereas, obviously, if you look at World War II aircraft launches, although there are catapults present at the time, most of the time they arrange a huge amount of aircraft on deck and they just put the lighter ones, mostly fighters, up front where they have the shortest takeoff run, and the more heavily loaded ones, like Avengers, as you can see here, are at the back, so they have the longest takeoff run. So, you know, what is your aircraft? You know, an Avenger stuck up front on a flight deck of a carrier that's having to run downwind or in calm probably can't get in the air. An F6F might have a decent chance at it. And then, of course, there's the takeoff rating. So you'll have a maximum takeoff weight, which is your, you know, absolute ideal circumstance for takeoff, which is probably, you know, sailing into a headwind at speed. You're fully loaded and you're right at the back of the carrier, so you've got the longest possible run-up. But between that and minimally loaded, there's a whole load of variations. So again, if we go back to a Hellcat, a fully fueled up Hellcat that is just carrying, let's say, machine gun ammo, so perhaps it's on a purely combat air patrol loadout, no drop tank, might well, you know, there's going to be enough of a difference between its takeoff weight then and its maximum takeoff weight that even if you were in a flat calm or sailing somewhat downwind, you might well still be able to take off even from the front or parking spot on a carrier. Whereas if that aircraft is also carrying maybe some bombs and some rockets and a fuel tank, because it's going to be strafing and attacking an enemy warship, then it's probably not going to be able to take off from that same front park rank if you don't have a headwind going across the deck as well as steaming. But perhaps if you don't have too many aircraft on the flight deck, then that same bomb, rocket and fuel tank loaded F6F, if it's at the back of the flight deck, like the Avengers scene here, then it might well have the acceleration to make it down that flight deck and make it into the air, even in a calm or with a tailwind. And of course, that's going to vary aircraft by aircraft, loadout by loadout, airspeed by airspeed, and ship by ship, because, you know, if you're trying to take off, let's say, HMS Victorious, that's got a relatively short flight deck compared to, let's say, USS Saratoga. So even if you had exactly the same situation of an F6F at the very back of the ship, Saratoga has a much longer flight deck than Victorious does. So all of these factors would have to be calculated to work out specifically what you would have to do to get that particular aircraft on that particular carrier in that particular weather circumstance airborne. But what you can probably tell from all that is that, yes, wind is very important, because if you're sailing into a headwind at speed, you get a massive benefit to what your aircraft can do. Odd Leah asks, inspired by a short I just watched about how tacking into the wind actually works, I'm now very curious about the manoeuvres part of sailing ship battles. Discussion always focuses on the cannon, but what about the men in the sails and the officers who had to coordinate the whole thing? A detailed dive into how officers and crew trained and specific manoeuvres would be lovely. Well, training and manoeuvres for Age of Sail, manoeuvring under sail, is actually a very complex and interesting topic. I think perhaps the best way of describing that would maybe actually be to people to see it happening. So maybe next time the Indiam and Gothenburg replica sails, maybe I'll get myself onto her crew, because last time they sailed, they actually offered spaces on various legs of their voyage. So maybe if they do the same thing, I'll get myself onto the crew and then I can actually show you how it's done, literally, while probably also murdering myself with vertigo. But, you know, sacrifices must be made. Nonetheless, in brief, when it comes to manoeuvres in battle, there aren't that many. Now, obviously, sails would still have to be brought in, taken out, etc., etc. But a lot of the time, the standard practice you would see is ships going into what's called battle sail. And this is actually one of the good ways of working out if a marine artist knows what they're talking about. Because if they depict a battle between Age of Sail vessels and the main sails, that is the lowest sails on the largest yards, are down, then either they are showing a very, very specific battle, usually one in very light airs, or they have got something horribly wrong. So you have to obviously check what exactly they're depicting. But most battles are fought under battle sail where that lowest sail is furled. And there's a few reasons for that. Partly it gets in the way of the upper gunners and its upper deck gunners and its huge fire risk. But also you have to manage these things. And when a ship is in battle, a good chunk of the crew are going to be fighting the ship. They're going to be manning the guns and so forth, perhaps also either preparing to be boarding parties or counter boarding parties. But also, when you are up in the sails and the rigging, you are hideously vulnerable to anything and everything, including small arms fire and shrapnel, especially if you're on a British ship and you're fighting a French ship who have a tendency to fire up into the rigging. So between that and the fact that, as anyone who's seen one of the more modern sailing ship, either replicas of old ships or perhaps the training vessels like the one the Italians have, when they're doing a full sail evolution, as it were, it's a hugely manpower intensive activity. So you can't really afford to have a good chunk of your crew up in the sails when you need them fighting the ship, apart from the whole, you know, vulnerability issue. And so once you've hoisted battle sail, of course, you've minimized the number of sails you actually have to keep an eye on within reason. Obviously, you still need propulsion and maneuverability and some degree of redundancy. But it then means that once you're in battle, obviously, if you're in a line of battle, you don't tend to have to make too many maneuvers. So it's not quite set it and forget it. You do still need to have some men around to make changes to the sail pattern as commanded by the captain, but nowhere near as many. Of course, once you get into Nelsonian-style melees, things get a lot more fraught. But this is one of the reasons, one of several reasons, why Nelsonian-style melees were avoided by a lot of navies for a good chunk of time. There are obviously other things like potential of ships being isolated and doubled up and getting lost and firing on the wrong people and all sorts of things like that. But one of the concerns is it takes a hugely more advanced amount of ship handling to sail in such a way that you can catch up and get roughly perpendicular to an enemy or on a perpendicular course, then cut through their lines and then cut back and forth as necessary to maneuver to bring yourself to bear against other ships, which theoretically will also be maneuvering, because not only is that ship handling in terms of, you know, the tiller or the wheel, depending on which part hasn't been shot away yet, but you also will need people constantly trimming the sails, and that A, draws away from your gunners, and B, it's a very hostile working environment, as we just detailed. So if you are able to maneuver your ship correctly in that kind of engagement, it is a huge plus to your credibility as a good crew and a good captain. Whereas a crew that gets something even ever so slightly wrong, you can suddenly end up with the wind backing up your sails and you're dead in the water and suddenly you're getting raked. PH89787 asks, where was the British Pacific Fleet during Typhoon Connie-Viper? At the exact moment that the US fleet was being battered by Typhoon Connie-Viper, the British Pacific Fleet was actually just off the eastern coast of Australia, because they'd wrapped up their second go at the Sakishima Islands at the end of May, and the main body of the British Pacific Fleet was heading down to Sydney, where they'd arrive basically over the 24 to 48 hour period after Connie and Viper. So at that point, they would have been off the, as I say, the eastern dash northeastern coast of Australia to undergo, you know, refit, resupply, etc., before they headed off for subsequent operations off the Japanese coast. So they were very well clear of the track of the typhoon. Anson Ellis asks, HMS Ark Royal was the only British carrier made to fight Japan. How would it have performed in this role? During the Indian Ocean raid, as I understand, Britain's carriers were operating with understrength fighter groups. Why was this? Well, you've got to bear in mind that the armoured carriers were also designed to be able to go out and fight in the Pacific. So it's not that Ark Royal is the only one designed specifically to fight Japan, but Ark Royal is designed perhaps more so for long-distance Pacific operations than operations in closer European and Mediterranean waters. So I was like, yeah, there's a qualified veracity to saying Ark Royal is the only Royal Navy carrier designed specifically to fight Japan. She's more suited for it, I would say, at least in conventional terms, pre-kamikaze. Now, before we get on to how well she would have performed, I'd say with the Indian Ocean raid, the British carriers aren't actually operating with below-strength fighter groups at that point. They're operating with fighter groups that are below strength compared to what they'd be operating with towards the end of the war. But for the time period and for their initially rated capacity, they're actually operating, believe it or not, with a slightly over-strength fighter group. Because remember, as originally designed, the armoured carriers, of which Indomitable and Formidable are two, were notionally rated to operate 36 aircraft. Formidable's actually running 38, and Indomitable, which does have slightly more hangar space, is actually running 45. And of those, Formidable has 16 martlets, aka wildcats, aboard, which is about 44 to 45% of her total air group. And Indomitable is running 9 Sea Hurricanes and 12 Fulmars, along with 24 albacores, which actually is about 47% of her total air group being fighters. And proportionally, that's actually about 80% more fighters as a proportion of the air group than US carriers are running at the very beginning of the war, at least the very beginning of the war in the Pacific, because remember, the US carriers are running 18, 18, 18, and 18. 18 torpedo bombers, 18 scout bombers, 18 dive bombers, and 18 fighters. Now, of course, thanks to the American carriers generally carrying more aircraft, that actually does mean roughly equivalent air groups. So, for example, at the Battle of Coral Sea, Yorktown's air group has 18 Wildcats aboard. So that's two more than Formidable, but three less than Indomitable. So if you average it out, the British carriers in the Indian Ocean are actually carrying roughly the same number of fighters as you would expect a contemporary US carrier to carry. It's just obviously they're carrying far less strike aircraft. Now, of course, you can debate the effectiveness of the Sea Hurricane and the Fulmar versus the Wildcat, but I'd note that just under half the number of aircraft that the British had for fighters at the Indian Ocean Raid were Wildcats anyway. The Fulmars, obviously, there being 12 of them. But in more general terms, why were the British carriers operating with relatively few aircraft? Well, partly slightly smaller, but also partly there was a shortage of aircraft generally. Indomitable and Formidable were some of the better equipped carriers at the time. But for those of you who've been following on with Admiral Cunningham's series on the channel, you'll know that around about this time in the Mediterranean, for example, with Crete and so forth, there were situations where the RAF were saying, look, we can't come out and cover you, not because we don't want to, but because we simply don't have the aircraft. And it's not that, oh, we've got enough aircraft for our operations, we can't spare some to cover the Navy. At points, the Desert Air Force was running out of aircraft to do even the most basic tasks for itself, let alone cover the Navy. And to be honest, the aircraft carriers in the Med were in a similar boat. And in early 42, that wasn't exactly an unusual situation. I mean, again, for those who've been following along with the Enterprise series, you'll know that at points in the middle of 1942, the US was facing a critical shortage of Dauntlesses, as in they physically didn't have any more remaining. They had the ones that were on the carriers, they had a handful that were in transit, and that was it. They were actually running out of dive bombers because they were losing them faster than they could replace them. And of course, they did rectify that situation, and so did the British later on. Now, as far as how well Ark Royal would have performed against the Japanese, it very much depends on when. Because if you look at, and also what her air group is, because if you look at Ark Royal in the start of World War II, towards the end of her lifespan, so just before Japan gets involved in the war, she's still operating over 50 aircraft, and about, roughly speaking, three quarters of them are Swordfish, which are pretty darn big. They're about 7-8 foot longer than a Wildcat and a little bit wider with wings folded compared to a wings folded Wildcat and compared to a unfolding Wildcat. One of the earlier models with fixed wings, it's got a wingspan that's, again, roughly speaking, about 7 foot wider. So Swordfish take up, folded or unfolded, somewhat more space than Wildcats do for the equivalent. And therefore, if she's operating with a three-quarter air group of Wildcats and the other, roughly speaking, just over a quarter being Fulmars, which are also fairly substantial aircraft, if you stocked her with predominantly Wildcats and maybe some Sea Hurricanes, she could take a fairly hefty air group. Assuming that they had enough to actually spare, if you applied the proportional levels of fighters to strike aircraft that you see on the British carriers that are actually in the Indian Ocean Raid, you would expect Ark Royal to maybe have 30 or so Wildcats or Martlets at the time aboard, and maybe 20 to 25 Swordfish-Albacores, which actually would have given her the single largest fighter group of any carrier in early 1942 in the Pacific, larger than the Japanese or the Americans, larger even than the air groups found on the Lexington and Saratoga. So I think in the early part of the war, she would have done pretty well at defending herself. In terms of attacking the Japanese, I think it would be a kind of six of one, half dozen of another, because while I absolutely do love the Swordfish, I also don't have much of a problem in admitting that sending a couple of dozen Swordfish against the combat air patrol of the Kido Butai is not a prospect if you want to collect your war pension. Whereas At the same time, the Royal Navy is the only one trained for full-on night strikes, so while a daytime assault by a couple of dozen swordfish, even with a heavy martlet escort, is probably going to end very badly, the flip side to that is that the British are the only ones who can hit the Japanese at night. And the Japanese don't really have any reply for that because they do not have any kind of night fighting doctrine for their aircraft developed at that stage. So as long as she can choose the time of her engagement, I think Ark Royal in the early part of the war would have done pretty well. And as I said, she probably would have had a fairly substantial fighter group. So, and combined with actually having fighter control and direction that worked, whereas the US Navy, even by the end of 42, was struggling quite heavily with the concept, I think she could have, in 42, with a deep, reasonable air group, she could have handled herself fairly well. As time goes on, let's say if she'd survived and gone through to being in the British Pacific Fleet, yeah, that could have been a little bit more difficult. On the one hand, she still would have had a superior air group to even the Implacable and Indefatigable, which would have been quite nice, you know, able to sell off some pretty hefty strike complements. However, unlike the later carriers, she doesn't have an armoured flight deck, so she would have been considerably more vulnerable on a similar level to, you know, Franklin, Bunker Hill, and any number of other US carriers if she'd actually been hit by kamikazes. Warrant Officer Will asks, how feasible would the battle cruiser concept have been in the age of sail? Could you build a lighter and potentially cheaper line ship, or did it offer zero benefits? Not in the way that you're thinking, because in the Age of Sail, unlike in the Age of Steel, it's not about armor penetration. It's more about just number of guns and weight of broadside. So battle cruisers traditionally have, you know, less armor, more speed, slightly fewer guns, but guns of the same weight. In that respect, if you were to, you know, say that what's the closest thing to that, actually, weirdly enough, the third rate would fit the concept of battle cruiser the best, because most well-built third rates, at least, were faster than most first rates. There were, of course, exceptions. They were usually as heavily built as first rate, so they had a reasonable degree of protection. And of course, they carried slightly fewer guns than first rates, but most decent third rates would still carry a similar type of gun. So 32 pounder lower gun deck, and then usually 18 pounders on the upper gun deck. They just were missing some of the lighter guns. So yeah, weirdly enough, the third rate, which was of course the most prolific of the ships of the line, technically is the closest match for a battle cruiser. And of course, the other thing is, you do tend to find the odd third rate buzzing around on its own or in a small groups, chasing down frigates, which are the cruiser equivalent, which is exactly what battle cruisers are supposed to be doing under their original design concept. So yeah, technically speaking, that's your battle cruiser, and it is cheaper than a first rate, but that's not really the, you know, the classic battle cruiser mission and design profile isn't really what the third rate is supposed to be. The third rate is more a kind of standard battleship as compared to the big boys of the first rates. So you could almost say that a third rate is more like the treaty battleship to the first rates Yamato. Now, if you step it down a level to that kind of intermediate era that the fourth rate ends up kind of leaving behind because it kind of gets discontinued, there are people who will argue that the US big frigates, so the three really big ones, Constitution, President, and United States, are a battle cruiser concept on the justification that they're fast enough to run away from anything that can kill them and can kill anything that's fast enough to catch them. However, I would be a little bit hesitant to accept that definition, because while having a 24-pounder main armament did mean that the big US frigates had a heavier broadside than most frigates of the time, having a 24-pounder lower gun deck was not unheard of at that time. You had both the small razes like Indefatigable, which predate the US frigates by some time, that already had 24-pounder main gun decks, and you had a number of large frigates that were built by Britain and France, etc., which also had 24-pounder main gun decks. And so at that point, it is a, if you like, cruiser armament, albeit a large cruiser armament. And while a well-trimmed US heavy frigate is generally faster than most capital ships, because of the way that ships, sailing ships work, a particularly fast third-rate, or indeed a particularly fast first-rate like Victory, in heavy weather would probably still be considerably faster, or at least fast enough to catch up, than a US heavy frigate. And as you see with Endymion versus President, there are ships that carry roughly equal firepower that are just as fast, if not faster, already present, and they are very definitely still considered frigates, aka cruisers. So if I would consider, if you're going to say what is the Age of Steel equivalent to something like USS Constitution, I would say she's more in the realms of something like a Baltimore-class heavy cruiser. So she's at the upper end of firepower for the, if you like, cruiser class of ships, and she's a very rounded and well-balanced design, a very tough opponent, but she does that partly by simply being somewhat larger than her opponents, which allows you to fit more stuff on it. Like the Baltimore class of 3,500 tons heavier than other treaty cruisers. If you want to go into what is the a frigate in the Age of Sail that could potentially be considered battle cruiser like, although I'd be hesitant to say that it is so, I would say the closest thing to what you're looking for is probably actually some of the razes that the British came up with as a response to the US heavy frigates in the War of 1812. Things like this ship, for example. Well, this was particular one is Barham, which wasn't razed during the War of 1812, but it's very similar to Magnificent, which was razed and did actually serve in the War of 1812. And these are razed third rates, razed 74 gunners, indefatigables for razed 64. And the reason why I'd say these are probably the closest you're going to get to battle cruisers in the frigate world in the Age of Sail is because being a razed 74, this ship has a 32-pounder main gun deck. So she has a much heavier armament than any contemporary cruiser, aka frigate. She's got the hull build of a ship of the line, i.e. effectively equivalent to protection, and she has the mast and rigging of a ship of the line, and therefore is quite swift and agile. So yeah, a razed 74 with its 32-pounder gun deck still intact, it's about the closest you're going to get to an Age of Sail battle cruiser. But even then, I'd say I'd still be hesitant with applying the concept. Because yeah, she's going to be faster than pretty much any ship of the line, and she's got a similar heavy firepower, but it's still not a perfect match. A.B. Coates asks, what were the do's and don'ts of using navies for diplomacy, soft power, or showing the flag? And what are some notable examples of it being done particularly well or particularly badly? There are two main arcs, and possibly a third, to using navies for diplomacy. The possible third is actually have the power to back up what you are offering or threatening. But that's more of a larger geopolitical thing. Specifically for navies, you really want two things. Firstly, if you're going to show up, then you have to work out what kind of message are you trying to send. If you're trying to send an overtly friendly message, you know, come aboard, see our ships, be friends with us, look at how big and powerful we are, etc., etc., then you want to send something relatively large. A cruiser is usually a good bet, at least in the Age of Steam and Steel, because a cruiser is large enough to accommodate people. It looks nice. They very often, you know, look very sleek and powerful. They're quite quick. But on a military strategic level, people understand that a cruiser, in most cases, is not going to be able to unleash sudden death and destruction on a massive scale, and therefore is not an overt threat. And they usually fit it out for this kind of purpose as well. Whereas if you want to send a rather more militaristic threat message, then you either go big or you go small. Because if you go big, show up with a battleship or several, that is a very direct, in-your-face look. This is the kind of power we can bring to bear. Your actions have displeased us to the point we have actually brought said force to bear. And, kind of back off or else. The other version of the militaristic threat is to actually turn up with something very small, a gunboat or a destroyer or something like that, especially if everybody else has shown up with lots of ships. And that's more of a dare, because then you're showing up and saying, yeah, look, you could, in theory, completely destroy this one tiny vessel that I've sent. However, if you do, what do you think's coming after it? Do you really, really want to try me? And at that point, not only does it make the point that you are confident enough in your latent strength that you don't even bother sending anything larger than, a small gunboat, a sloop or a destroyer, but it also makes everybody else look small by comparison, because if you've got 3, 4, 5 or more enemy ships, or potentially enemy ships, facing off against 3, 4, 5 or more other potentially enemy ships, and the thing that brings them to heel is something that's a tenth the size of one of the respective side's flagships, that shows an awful lot of strength. So that's one arc, is, work out the right ship for the right circumstance. The other thing is, who is your audience? Because different shows of naval strength or diplomacy, soft power, will work very differently on different countries. And I think two diametrically opposed ways of this working are about 50 years apart. The first one, as seen here, this is the Great French Naval Review at Cherbourg, with the big French three-decker Bretagne in the middle. Now, this is a classic example of not reading the room at all, because the idea of the French was to show Britain that the French Empire, which it was at this point, a few years later it would be a republic again, but nonetheless, for the minute we're an empire. The point was, the French Empire is big and strong and wants to be friendly with you, and look, we're showing off all our military might, so join with us and we can reshape Europe between us to our will. However, they'd modelled this on British naval reviews, and British naval reviews were very explicitly, this is where our strength lies, you don't want to mess with us. So they took the style of the British use of naval diplomacy, but failed to completely understand what exactly that would be perceived as. Again, your audience is important. For a continental power like Spain or Italy or Germany or something like that, this kind of thing would make perfect sense. It shows off a huge amount of French military power, but in a manner that is not a direct threat to the country in question. The French army would be the much bigger threat to a continental European power. But to the British, putting a massive fleet of modern warships in Cherbourg, right opposite the southern English coast, would only ever be read one way, and that was, as far as the British were concerned, a perception of, oh look, the French have a massive fleet that could invade us any moment, they must be trying to send some kind of message that, they are strong and they are coming for us, this is a threat, we need to act on that. And suddenly Anglo-French relations took a bit of a nosedive, and the British spent the next few years in building up even further in a naval arms race with France, which was the exact opposite of what the French actually wanted. That was doing it very badly. The flip side of doing it very well occurs in 1905. This is a very, very forgotten episode of things, and actually, thanks to Professor Andrew Lambert at the recent Naval History Conference I hosted for drawing this to everyone's attention. And then I did some more research to find out what this was all about. So what happened in 1905 was, the Russo-Japanese War is going on, and Britain is trying to let the fight stay between Russia and Japan. They don't want the system of alliances to start falling like dominoes, which is obviously what happens in World War I, although with a different proximate cause. And so they are trying to keep in alliance with France, but also they're trying to get France to back off from helping Russia too much, which obviously the Japanese are also keen not for the Russians to have a lot of help, and they don't want France to get involved. And into all of this, the Kaiser decides to stick his oar in and basically decides, okay, well, look, the Russians are in a weak position because the vast majority of the Baltic fleet is now either off sailing around the world or destroyed eventually at the Battle of Tsushima. And so the Russians are feeling vulnerable, so perhaps I can leverage that over them. And if I can agitate the French, then they will either have to fall back on their alliance with Britain, or else they'll have to give in to what I want. So he starts pressuring the French and starts threatening war with the French, because they're not going to get a huge amount of backup from Russia at this point. And of all things, he actually asks for a Atlantic port for the German fleet, which is also calculated as a sort of bit of a poke in the eye to the British. And he's essentially saying, look, if you don't give me what I want, there may be a war, and Russia's armies aren't going to come and save you, because Russia's in a complete mess after the Russo-Japanese War, which means you're going to have to rely on the British. And can you really rely on the British? What exactly can the British do if I start threatening you with a land war? And in a classic case of British politics, the British politicians, the government, are running around with the blindfold on. They really genuinely have very little idea how to handle this. Bunch of inept muppets, as usual. They're trying to placate Germany, which, if anyone knows anything about the Kaiser, is exactly the wrong thing to do. But, well, no one ever accused British politicians of being particularly smart in the 20th and the 21st century, so there you go. Fischer, on the other hand, knows exactly what to do. So Fischer basically arranges for the Channel Fleet, which you can see here, HMS Triumph, is the ship in the foreground. He basically says to the Channel Fleet, look, we are going to go and we're going to sail into the Baltic, because one of the things that the Kaiser's been trying to do is poke the Russians into Anglophobia and persuade the Russians that under benevolent German guidance, of course, they can make the Baltic a closed-off sea to the British, which, of course, the Russians in a moment of naval vulnerability think is quite a nice idea. And Fischer organises the Channel Fleet. He gets them ready to sail and basically doesn't tell anyone in the government that this is what he's doing until pretty much the last possible moment. And the government, which is, again, in a very pacifying and placating mood, thinks that this is terrible, but this is going to provoke Germany. There could be war, because it's a show of martial strength. And Fischer's kind of sitting there going, yes, that is kind of the point. I want to scare them because I don't want them to go to war. I want to threaten them to the point they back down. And luckily for Fischer, he's made a few strategic leaks to the press and to the Germans. So the Germans know, theoretically, that the Channel Fleet is coming. The press know that it's coming. And it's so close to sailing that the government eventually decides that the domestic political hit of suddenly cancelling the Channel Fleet and looking like you're scared of the Germans would be far worse for their voting public than letting it go ahead. So they let it go ahead. Now, of course, as anybody who knows anything much about the Baltic will know, sailing around Denmark into the Baltic and the various harbours therein is not exactly easy. You usually will need local guides and pilots to do so, or you stick to very specific shipping channels in good weather. Fischer, however, of course, and the Channel Fleet, they have access to Admiralty charts, which are all very detailed, suspiciously in the case of Copenhagen. And elements of the High Seas Fleet have sailed in to Copenhagen, and they're having a little review and using their diplomatic soft power of their fleet. And then completely out of the blue, everyone is unaware that the British are anywhere nearby because they haven't chartered any pilots, they haven't chartered any guides or anything like this. The Channel Fleet just shows up on a foggy day, so they literally don't even see them coming. They don't know they're coming generally, but they don't see them coming at that point. And then out of the fog emerges the Channel Fleet, having navigated entirely off its own bat, And not only do they show up in Copenhagen, they show up and slot themselves neatly between the German fleet and the shoreline, which is a feat of seamanship which would be difficult in the best of circumstances, let alone in a heavy fog when they don't have any local pilots to hand. And this is where this photo is taken, after the fog has cleared a little bit. And so the Germans are looking at it going, where the heck did they come from? The Danes are looking at it and going, hee, this is funny. The British are back in Copenhagen. Help. The Russians are going, where the heck did they come from? And the British are going, look, we can show up with a massive fleet in your home waters whenever we like, wherever we like, and there's precious little you can do about it. The message is received by the Germans, who kind of go, okay, we're backing off. Yeah, that. So when we were saying, what are the British going to do if we threaten the French? It turns out that Fisher talking about just showing up at random and potentially blowing away our entire fleet. They can actually do that. Recalculation time. And the diplomatic crisis kind of blows itself out, and there isn't a World War I in 1905. And you see, Fisher's policies worked. In large part, the reason we ended up with World War I is because the government decided that they wanted to abandon Fisher's policies. And, well, look where that got us. The Outer Circle asks, a bit of a long meandering question, so sorry in advance, but the Germans are often lauded for the greater armour thickness on their battlecruisers. But it seems a bit pointless to me, as the weapons they would likely be facing up against were 13.5, 14-inch or 15-inch weapons, which could easily overwhelm the armour layout that they chose. Wouldn't it have made more sense for the British to have the German armour scheme, considering the preponderance of 11 and 12-inch weapons in the German fleet? And would the Germans have thus been better off going with thinner armour and higher speed and better armament, even without the benefit of hindsight? Theoretically, yes, because, as you say, much as the German battlecruisers, people say, oh yes, well, they're so much better protected. When you actually look at the statistics of what can an 11-inch or 12-inch gun penetrate, obviously most of the German battlecruiser fleet having 11-inch guns, versus what can a 13.5-inch gun penetrate, it turns out that, or even a British 12-inch for that matter, it turns out that essentially, certainly when you're looking at the 13.5-inch armed British ships, the additional protection that the Germans have is negated by the larger caliber and better penetration of the British guns, and therefore you end up in a situation where, roughly speaking, both sides can threaten each other at about the same range. The British have a slight advantage, in actual fact, again, on paper. Their shells can, in theory, punch through the Germans' thicker armour at slightly longer ranges than the Germans' smaller guns can punch through the thinner British armour. Of course, in practice, issues with the British shells mean it doesn't quite work out that way, but that's a specific issue with the shells, not the general design concept. So, yeah. But the Germans almost end up with British-style battlecruisers. The initial designs for von der Tann do reflect a British-style, somewhat larger guns, somewhat higher speed, somewhat less armour approach, but it gets revised at almost the last minute, not particularly because the Germans are trying to create a specific counter to the British battlecruisers, although that is part of the mission of the German battlecruisers. But whereas in British doctrine, at least initially when they're designing the battlecruisers, the battlecruiser is supposed to sweep the seas of raiders and regular cruisers first, and then form part of the scouting element of the fleet, and then, if the scouting element is done, while they are technically supposed to then form part of the battle line, what a lot of people get wrong is that they're not supposed to form part of the battle line that actually fights the enemy straight up. What they're supposed to do is form a fast wing of the battle line, and the idea of that is the British battle line will engage the German battle line, and then the fast wing will go ahead of that engagement, cross the T, and focus all of their firepower on the lead German ships, which are already engaged with British battleships, overwhelm them, smash them up, break up the enemy formation, battle is won. Fantastic, because everyone else kind of piles in or loses formation. Everything gets confused. Great. And if they run away, then obviously the battle cruisers can chase them down and further blow them up. So at no point are the British battle cruisers really supposed to be facing off against equal firepower, with the possible exception of during their scouting role, because the Germans put their battle cruisers in the scouting role as well. But the German battle cruiser doctrine doesn't really involve clearing enemy cruisers and raiders off the high seas. They know that's really impractical and impossible. So their first role is as fleet scouts, hence why they're in the first scouting group. But their second role is explicitly to join the battle line, as essentially in the same context that armoured cruisers joined the battle lines of pre-dreadnought fleets, when those pre-dreadnought fleets were somewhat smaller than their opponents. So unlike the British, where, yes, you might be shot at, but it's hopefully unlikely by a battleship, the Germans are explicitly expecting their battle cruisers to be shot at by enemy battleships. And that means that they think, okay, we need to put more armour on them to give them a degree of survivability in the face of considerable firepower. Now, obviously, the effort to balance speed, protection and firepower results in what we get with the German battlecruisers, which, okay, they are more durable if they are facing off against enemy battleships than the British battlecruisers would be. But equally, the British battlecruisers, as I said, don't have to do that. And it turns out you can still pretty heavily plaster the German battlecruisers and disable them in relatively short order anyway. So would the Germans have been better off going with thinner armour, slightly higher speed and larger armament? Yes and no. I think if they'd gone more British style with their battlecruisers, given the precise historical circumstances, especially with the issues the British shells were having, they probably would have done even better in the run to the south than they historically did. Because if you look at the number of shell hits that the battlecruisers that didn't blow up, especially HMS Tiger, took, and you look at their location, if those hits had been with 13.5-inch, or I guess we had the Germans 13.4-inch weapons, there is a fairly decent chance at least two more British battlecruisers, possibly more, would not have been coming home that day. The flip side, of course, is that when the first scouting group gets shot at by the Queen Elizabeths, when they get shot at by the Grand Fleet later on in the engagement, at that point, having 6 or 9-inch armour plate, even with British shells underperforming as they historically did, probably would have then meant the German battlecruiser losses start adding up pretty darn quickly. So it's almost literally you'd win some, you'd lose some. Wienwehr asks, did any other navy besides the Royal Navy have a training course like the Perisher during the period the Channel covers? Were there ever similar courses for officers commanding surface ships? And if not, why is it unique? So there aren't similar intense training courses for surface ships, partly because what a surface ship may be called upon to do is a much broader scope of things, not something that can really be hammered into you in a 24-week course. Whereas a submarine, it's a submerged torpedo attack platform. That is almost entirely its sole modus operandi. That can be taught or examined in a much more compacted environment. And the other thing is, obviously, submarines generally, and especially in the time period the Channel covers, have a much smaller crew than surface ships. So progressing up the chain in a submarine is actually a much faster rate of progress than on a surface vessel. Because on a surface vessel, you might have, you know, obviously the captain, the executive officer, first officer, etc., depending on your navy. But then below them will be numerous other officers, department heads, subdivision leads, and so forth. And if you're working your way up to the command position on a surface ship, you will be going up that, gradually learning the skills you need as you go. Whereas on a submarine, very, very small number of officers. So you go from basically just being a junior lieutenant through to being potentially the XO with relatively few steps. There's also a little bit more pressure when it comes to submarines. Ha ha, he says, submarines diving, pressure, blah, blah, blah. But nonetheless, it is a genuine thing, because if you are on a battleship or a cruiser, you undertake your command, perhaps during battle, you take a hit or two. It's not good, but usually that's kind of to be expected. It's part and parcel of the expectation of going into battle. If you're on a submarine and you take a hit, whether it be from a depth charge or a torpedo, that's probably it. The stakes are quite high relative to most surface engagements. And so the submarines are uniquely suited for a Perisher-type school. And then particularly when it comes to the Royal Navy, the Perisher is pretty much unique amongst the various naval training courses for submarine commanders and XOs. There are some similar training schools that are installed by various navies during the time period the channel covers. For example, one example, the Kriegsmarine has a fairly intense training school for U-boat commanders and executive officers. However, and this is a point I think I've raised a few times before in various dry docks, when it comes to Perisher and also the Royal Navy generally, especially in the time period the channel covers, and I believe to a certain extent also today, almost all other navies to some degree or other expect the captains and XOs to be as much engineers as anything else, to understand all the systems of their boats or ships in such a way that if something goes wrong, they can be expected to at least know what's gone wrong and why, possibly even fix it themselves if time allows. And now in the Royal Navy, while they certainly didn't stop people becoming subject matter experts if they chose, the main point of being a captain or an XO on a Royal Navy ship was to be able to lead the ship, i.e. lead and command the men, command their respect, and with that, to then take the ship into battle. So you were a commander and you were a tactician. The Royal Navy didn't really care if whether or not you knew how the ship operated beyond the basics of ship go forward, ship go backwards, we use oil or coal or whatever. So outside of that very basic stuff, the Royal Navy did not expect you to be able to operate, in the case of submarines, your submarine's diesels or fix them. What they expected you to do was to say to the engineering staff, what do you need? I need this. What do you need to do it? Can we do this? Yes, no. Okay, now I have the situation. I will adapt my tactics accordingly. And so Perisher is essentially a command and tactics school only. And that's what makes it in part so harsh and in part so specialised, whereas similar-ish courses like the Kriegsmarine one, there's a huge amount more technical elements to it, understanding the technology of the submarine beyond what's necessary to actually fight the sub. 31 Not Burke, Chief of Naval Operations, asks, why does the New Guinea campaign seem to have such a small naval aspect compared to the Solomon Islands campaign? There's a whole mix of factors. Partly, to be honest, the New Guinea naval campaign does get very heavily overlooked. It certainly is there. And there are plenty of, for example, Royal Australian Navy veterans who either have in the past or even now would tell you about their various adventures there. Another aspect is because the Solomons campaign and other island campaigns in the Pacific were going on at the same time, with obviously the US Navy and the Japanese Navy clashing, that tended to draw most of the heavy military assets in that direction. Another element was that the Solomon Island campaign and subsequent campaigns represented either the Japanese trying to push the boundaries of their advance towards the Americans, or later on the Americans coming into Japanese-held territory. So again, much more likely to concentrate lots of heavy forces there. Whereas New Guinea was a little bit further from places like Rabaul, where Japanese naval force had to be gathered and sent out from. Conversely, obviously, also somewhat closer to Australia. And the main island involved is pretty big in and of itself. And so when the Japanese are trying to provide their reinforcements and the Australians and the Americans are trying to provide their reinforcements, broadly speaking, they're pretty much going for opposite sides of the landmass. And so as compared to somewhere like, say, Guadalcanal, where the different reinforcement fleets are often within a handful of miles, maybe a couple of dozen miles at best, of each other, and therefore can very easily go and have a go at each other. When you've got an island the size of New Guinea in between the two of you, it's much more difficult to, you know, send forces round to go and disrupt the enemy's supplies while you're also trying to escort your own. Now, that's not to say that wasn't attempted. There were various attempts, some by surface ships, a lot by submarines, to disrupt the other guy's supply line. Australian escorts, for example, had all sorts of fun chasing down and sinking various Japanese submarines that were trying to disrupt the Allied supply line. But, again, the other theatres were drawing a lot of the major Japanese naval attention. Geography kind of got in the way. And to a certain extent, because Japanese supply efforts were coming out of places like Truk and Rabaul, and to a lesser extent, places like Formosa, those areas were also supplying the Japanese front lines for things like the Marianas campaign later on, the Solomon Islands campaign earlier on. And so those places and the supply convoys coming to and from them tended to get attacked by Allied fleet elements, including, of course, submarines, that were supporting, if you like, the main campaign in the Pacific island chains anyway. So the Japanese supply line to New Guinea got hit pretty hard, even though it wasn't specifically targeting the New Guinea supply line. Although, of course, there were, as I said, also some operations that would specifically target things more at the tail end of that, close to New Guinea. The Rogue Chief asks, do you know if you'll get a chance to interview someone who worked in a shipyard building the ships that you cover, especially during the Second World War? I imagine that, like the military veterans of that generation, there probably aren't that many left, but you never know. And what's the normal turnaround time for answering alternate history questions? So in terms of will I be able to interview somebody who worked at a shipyard building ships during World War II? Maybe. I don't know. As you said, you know, these people would be getting on a bit. I mean, let's say they started work in 1940 and they were aged 20, just to make things easy to calculate. So that would mean that they were born in 1920, which would mean that these days they'd be 106. Now, of course, they might have started work a little bit later and been a bit younger, which might push them to only being in their late 90s. But yeah, not a huge number of them left, especially compared to when I was a kid, when there were still plenty of World War I veterans around, let alone World War II. So it essentially comes down to, if there are people out there who are World War II veterans who would like to talk about their experiences, I'm all ears to give them interviews, but I don't know where they are. So if you happen to know one who does want to talk about what they did, please let me know. As for the turnaround on alternate history questions, that's a little bit of an open-ended question. Basically, I fell behind quite a bit doing live streams last year through a mixture of illness, being really busy doing other things for the channel, etc. I'm now trying to make it up. The last few months, I've been able to fairly regularly keep up with one alternate history Patreon live stream per month. And each of those months, we've been covering 2 months worth of alternate history questions. So we're catching up gradually. So essentially, the turnaround time is, I think I'm about 5-6 months behind at the moment, but I am gradually catching up. And the idea is that once I have caught up, then the turnaround time will be relatively minimal. So you'll get the Patreon dry dock at the end of the month, and then a couple of weeks later, you'll get the alternate history live stream dry dock. So essentially, in both cases, it'll be, you know, the previous month's questions. And I'm hoping to reach that point at some point later this year, because, of course, every month there's a new set of alternate history questions. So I'm slowly catching up, and yeah, we'll catch up this year at some point. Don't know exactly when, though. And finally, Nosdormu89 asks, in one of my previous questions about U-boat operations in the Indian and Pacific Oceans, you said that only one U-boat reached and operated in the Pacific and didn't do much of note. That leaves me wondering, what did it do? Which U-boat was it, and what happened to it? So a reasonable number of U-boats made it to join the Monsoon Gruppe, possibly, which was a German and occasionally Italian submarine formation operating mostly to attack Allied supplies in the Indian Ocean, and also the bases that they had at Batavia-Jakarta and at Penang were also the kind of first stage receiving areas for cargo submarine runs shuttling back and forth between Germany and Japanese-held territory. However, firstly, the attrition rate of the submarines trying to reach the Monsoon Gruppe bases was appalling, and even those that made it there tended to not have particularly long lives for the most part. And their operational area was the Indian Ocean, so, you know, going essentially west and south of their positions and very occasionally operating off the western coast of Australia. There was one effort by the Germans in late 1944, early 1945, to try and enter the Pacific War, at least technically speaking. And the idea was that if they could get these U-boats onto the Australian East Coast, dash New Zealand Western Area waters, then that would force the Allies to redeploy anti-submarine assets down there, because at this point the Japanese had been pressed well back. They weren't going to get submarines into the area very easily. And therefore, by drawing off Allied naval assets, it might lessen the pressure on the Japanese. Now, they weren't dumb enough to try and sail past New Guinea, so they were going to have to go from Jakarta-Batavia down through the Java Sea and around Australia going anti-clockwise. Initially, therefore, probably no surprise, they just nominated two Type 9D U-boats, the really big long-range ones, a U-168 and U-862. And then they thought, two U-boats, maybe not enough. We'll stick U-537 in there as well, which was a Type 9C-40. But 168 and 537 were sunk en route without actually even getting close to Australia by Allied forces. So they said, okay, right, meh, well, one isn't going to be enough, so we'll send U-196 to back up U-862, 196 being another 9D2, and 196 disappeared as well. So, yeah, out of the four U-boats that tried to get into the Pacific proper, only U-862 actually made it. However, the Allies, through signals intel, knew she was coming. The Australians therefore just went, okay, well, we'll just not have ships on her route. And as a result, she only actually found three targets worth attacking: a Greek freighter that she missed, a Liberty ship, the Robert J. Walker, which, by being sunk off New South Wales right at the end of 1944, technically became the only Allied ship in the Pacific just to be sunk by the Kriegsmarine, at least by Kriegsmarine U-boats, that is. It then failed to find any other targets worthy of note, was ordered to come back, and off Fremantle on the western side of Australia, so back in the Indian Ocean, she saw a third target, the US Liberty ship, the Peter Sylvester, which she also sank. So she managed to sink two ships, only one of which was only just about in the Pacific. Then she fetched back up to Batavia, then up to Singapore, and while she was in Singapore, Germany surrendered, so she was commissioned into the Japanese Navy as I-502, but in common with three other German and two Italian submarines that were also in the general area and taken over by the Japanese, she didn't actually do much of anything because the Japanese wanted to recrew her, but they didn't have the crew or the training to do so initially, and by the time they got round to even thinking about putting men aboard her, it was too late, and Japan had surrendered. And so that was pretty much the end of U-862. She was then taken out of Singapore and scuttled. And that brings us to the end of this week's Dry Dock. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening, and I hope to see you again in another video soon. Bye for now.